gentlemen, welcome to a very special episode of One Perfect Game, the show about video games and the people who play them. My name's Matt Tilby. I am your host for this wonderful adventure. And my guest for today's episode actually helps score games. He is a BAFTA-nominated British composer who's created soundtracks for games including GoldenEye, Banjo-Kazooie and Tui, Perfect Dark and Donkey Kong 64, to name just a few. Next year, you'll be able to hear his latest work, this time for the latest installment in the Mario and Rabbids series, Sparks of Hope. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Grant Kirkhope. Grant, it is an honour to have you on the show. Welcome on in.
Well, thanks for asking me. It's very nice to ask me. I think I ask the old bloke out now and then. It's all right.
You've certainly been, a popular figure in the world of gaming over the last 20 or so years. And I mean, you must be getting so many people in their mid-20s and 30s who've come up and like, you've been such an integral part of my gaming upbringing and sort of my gaming childhood. So I guess I'm probably not the first person of my ilk to be asking you on a podcast. How does it feel having that sort of, popularity all these years later?
I don't know about popularity. I don't like to think about that really. I'm not like a kind of egotistical guy. I just think I'm a bloke that writes tunes that people like now and then, like just like a job like anybody else. That's how I like to think about it really. I don't like to think about the kind of all that nonsense. but I guess it's like 20, like you say, 20, what, 2 years or whatever it is. I started in 95. I can't do my math. 2005.
Yeah, about 25 years.
Yeah. So it's certainly getting on. Like you say, it's that point where people that are 20, 30 are like, you know, remembering the stuff that I did. So it just means that I'm just old, right? So it's just, you know, you start to realise that you just are getting old. And, I'm very grateful to still be employed, really. I mean, I think that, you know, the fact that people still want to hire me to do music is amazing to me as it is to everybody else.
Well, I mean, you've certainly been a busy boy in the last, you know, two or so years. You did World of Warcraft Shadowlands last year, and then in 2019 you did the second game in the Yooka-Laylee series, and then I guess sort of rearranging or reviving the Spiral Mountain arrangement for Banjo-Kazooie in Super Smash Bros. In 2019. Like, the variety that you've had over the last sort of couple of years has certainly been something, hasn't it?
It's nice to get asked to do different stuff. Like, I think that, you know, it's easy to get tarred with the kind of platformy, jolly, happy, jolly, quirky thing that Banjo-Kazooie was, you know, because I guess people remember that really vividly to this day, you know. So it's nice to get asked to do, like, World of Warcraft and Civilization and Kingdoms of Amalur and, like, Minecraft Dungeons. I did that early this year. You know, so it's cool to do lots of different stuff. Even like Minecraft Dungeons is like completely out of my wheelhouse. It's like very synthy, ambient sort of stuff, you know, so I was chuffed that they asked me to do it. And I really enjoyed it. It was great fun and they seemed to like it, you know, so it's nice to get asked to different stuff, you know, so I do like that. Because it stretches you a little bit, I mean, you know, to do different things. But, you know, quite honestly, I'm happy to do anything. As long as somebody wants to employ me, you know, I'm happy to do it. I don't care what it is, I'm happy to do it, really.
Yeah, I mean, given how easy it was to contact you, I'm sure there'll be someone getting into your inbox pretty soon. But as mentioned at the start, obviously one of your upcoming works is Mario & Rabbids Sparks of Hope. And I watched this interview that you gave prior to the release of the first game where you sort of spoke about the sort of pressure that you felt composing for a Mario game. And I believe still to this day, you're the first Western composer for a Mario title. And would you say you still feel that pressure now that you've got that first game in the bag? Or is there a new sort of expectation on you for this new title?
No, I still feel the pressure, definitely. I feel like it has to be better than last time. I feel like I was still quite new to it last time. I think when I started the game last time, I didn't really realise what it was going to end up as. So I was kind of in that quite sort of happy, jolly, sort of, you know, not particularly serious kind of music kind of thing. But the game gets quite serious at the end. So, and I didn't know that, but they did. They just didn't tell me. So I didn't know it was going to. So, you know, it changed, I kind of feel, halfway through. You know, as it progressed to the end of the game, to the big climax. So I still don't really know that much about Sparks of Hope, honestly. I'm really only just getting into it, really, at the moment. So I don't know what the end is going to be, anything like that. So, you know, but I've already had to do Rosalina's tune for the trailer. and that had to be run past Koji Kondo again, you know, like I did with the last game, with the stuff they did for his last game. So that was nerve-wracking always, you know, kind of thing. You know, and I mean, the fact that Koji Kondo's going to listen to the stuff that I do that's his, is that is frightening, because, you know, he's the Jedi Master, I'm just a Padawan, right? So, you know, it's like, it's quite, it is daunting. But I mean, you know, I kind of feel it's equal parts exciting, and it really is equal parts scary.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, the next question I wanted to ask was, I guess, how much leeway were you given on Kingdom Battle? I know that you'd spoken about how you wanted to utilize and work off the previous work of Koji Kondo, and how much, I guess, in terms of that creative freedom, how much did that differ to the other composing opportunities you've had, say, over the last 5 or so years?
So I haven't really done anything that's been somebody else's work, I don't think, like, that I've had to redo, apart from when I did Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusion on the iPad for Sega Australia. I had to use some of the original music for that game, so I had to do arrangements of that. But since that, I haven't really done anything really. I've always done my own stuff. So having to use Koji Kondo's stuff was like, you know, not only have to arrange someone else's music, but the fact that it's him is really frightening, you know. And I only really had to do it's called Peach's Castle in Mario Rabbids Kingdom Battle. So I had to rearrange that. And it's the castle theme from Super Mario 64.
Yes.
You know, which, of course, I absolutely, you know, loved doing that, because that was my, you know, I remember at Rare, we all got our N64s together. We all got them bought for us, and we all got Mario 64. So that's a really big, you know, a big landmark. And anybody my age is kind of, I think, gaming life, is that was such an amazing game, you know. So, and then for this game, I've only had, I've only had to do so far Rosalina's tune that I did in the trailer. So what's to come in the game? Yeah, I really don't know. I don't know what Mr. Soliani's got in store for me, should I say. So I'll have to wait and see. But that's what I've done so far. And that you had to listen to that, you know, I like it too. You know, and I did make some mistakes yet again, so like I did last time. Because I have to do it by ear, right? And I keep missing a couple of notes out. So, but it was all right in the end. So I don't know what this game's got in store yet. I really don't.
Nice. You did obviously mention Super Mario 64. That was, I guess, the key game for me in my sort of gaming upbringing. And there was another interview you sort of mentioned World of Warcraft being sort of the game that you played quite a bit at Rare, and you were, I guess, coming home from shifts at Rare to jump on Raze. That was, I guess, I mean, we should say for the purposes of this episode, it's very much just a pure interview, as Grant couldn't find a game to I guess discuss. But I guess World of Warcraft, it certainly comes close for you, at least the original form.
Yeah, definitely. I think that like Chris Seaver, the guy that designed Conker, you know, he's a big Warcraft player. In fact, we both played Star Wars Galaxies before that, and then he said there's this new game coming along that's, you know, it's another big open world thing, you know. So we switched to World of Warcraft. Must have been like, yeah. I can't remember what year it was. It was in the very early 2000s. I mean, I think it might have even been 99. I'm not sure. I feel like 2000, about round about there. So, you know, I had to dash back because I joined a European guild, so they're an hour ahead of the UK. So I had to get back from Rare, get back in time for 6 o'clock, because 7 o'clock when the raid started, right? So dash back, say a quick hello to the wife, you know, and then go and hide in my room and play Warcraft for hours on end, doing the big raids. And I mean, I think it's, you know, I guess my wife here says it's, you know, it's close to divorce. She's sick of me playing that bloody game. I did play that for years, and really, and the only reason I stopped was because I moved to the USA in 2008. And I called Blizzard in the UK and said, or whatever the helpline was, to say I wanted to bring my little mage character to the US. And they said, well, we don't do international transfers. There's some kind of server incompatibility.
No.
And I was like, you know, I just spent all these years building my little mage up to the top it could possibly be, you know, with the best gear and all that and stuff. And I couldn't transfer him, you know. So I was heartbroken. So I thought, I was like, I'm not playing it anymore. So I gave up for a little while. So I did start playing again when we moved to Baltimore, maybe a year after we moved out, 2009, I think. I had to start from scratch, go and get back to whatever level I was. I think maybe it was Cataclysm by that point, or the Lich King, I can't remember. And then I kind of stopped and we moved over here, you know, kind of thing. But what's fun now is that my son, who was then, you know, one or two, is now 18. So we're actually playing the Shadowlands together. at the moment
with
his friend, which is fantastic fun. You know, I guess they think I'm the old guy, I'm a bit slow. You know, wandering around, you know, the Moor and Rivendell, because I've just watched Lord of the Rings, Revendreth, I mean, you know, wandering around there, hearing my music playing in the background, it's just, for me, it's fantastic to think that something I've written has made it into. I mean, Warcraft has always got like a big roster of fantastic composers, it's like Neil Acree and David Arkenstone, Jeff Lefkowitz, me. Not that I'm great, but they are. And, you know, so to be up amongst those guys is amazing. And, you know, it really is a real thrill for me to wander around the levels and hear some of my stuff start to play in the background. It's brilliant. Totally brilliant.
I was going to say, it's like you, I guess, had that opportunity to say to them, look, I played the game. Like, I've been in it for hours and hours, risked my marriage, really, to get to this point. Like, it must have been a wonderful feeling being able to jump into a franchise and, you know, produce for a series that you've loved for so long.
Oh, yeah, absolutely fantastic. You know, and the guys at Blizzard are super nice. Derek Duke and Charlotte, I think she's called Charlotte Pyle now. She's changed her name. It was Charlotte Moore. She just got married. So those are my main contacts there. Derek Duke's been there for like 20 years, probably maybe longer. Charlotte's been there a little while. And they were super nice to me, like, you know, and it was just, I feel like they've done it for such a long time that they treat the composers so well. You get lots of information, you get lots of artwork to look at, any description you want to do, the right descriptions out of everything. So you kind of get the full, even though you haven't seen it, like actually in the game, you get sort of plenty of, you know, as I say, little videos and everything that, you know, just that you can get the thing you're writing for. You know, yeah. And it's, you know, and we were going to actually record it up at Skywalker Ranch, you know, up there. And that's where they were going to record it. But it was right when COVID hit last March.
Ah, right.
So that was off. And then, so actually recorded it in Australia, actually, in Sydney, at the remotely at Trackdown. I think it's called Trackdown.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, 4 PM for us is like 9 AM for you guys. So we were all online at 4:00, monitor, you know, you get these big like internet streaming services that stream live recordings in super high quality, so you see it in real time and you can listen to it in real time and you can talk to the orchestra and all that, like, as if you were there.
Yeah.
So we did all that. We had a schedule, you know, we knew what times we needed to be online at night to get kind of thing. We used to run from like 4 PM for us to, I think, 11 at night. That's when we were there, you know, online to be there. And we knew what time we'd be online. And so you'd log on, you know, and talk to the guys and listen to the orchestra play it and say, yeah, you know, that's great. I'll do it again, whatever. So, yeah, it was all done in Australia because your COVID wasn't so bad. It wasn't bad at all when it kicked off last March. It was like, you know, it was probably June, actually. It was a bit after March. But you didn't get much COVID at all. So you were all just, all the orchestra was in the room. I think there was distancing, like, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
No, brilliant. Yeah.
I guess that was another question I wanted to ask, was obviously with the pandemic that happened and obviously with a lot of your work, I mean, probably needing to be a little bit more in person to get more, you know, collaboration and conferencing. How did that affect, I guess, games that you had been working on at the time? Did you have to, you know, find different ways to get your compositions across to other people, or how did that affect your line of work?
Actually, it was all right. It didn't really affect my work at all, really. Funny enough, I think that the movie industry suffered really badly because you had to be on set with people, so they had to cancel all the productions, and they get hit really hard. But the games guys, not really. Like, once the big companies, the computer that I work for, got used to, you know, working from home, it was all just back to normal, really. So I didn't really notice a difference at all. I think initially maybe it started a little bit just before people got used to working from home and they got the whole company out and all that stuff, you know. Not really. I feel people were at home playing games, so games sort of stepped up a little bit, really, if anything. They were like, you know, it's got busier. So I think Blizzard in particular, you know, they're such a giant company. It did take them a little bit of time to get everybody at home, but I mean they essentially launched World of Warcraft while working from home, which is quite an achievement. Like,
yeah,
it got put back slightly, the Shadowlands thing, but only a little bit. So it got really, you know, all the artwork, all the stuff was just done from home and pieced together by all the programmers and all that, and I guess the main servers at Blizzard use those, and I mean it just as normal, you know.
Nice. Yeah,
great.
I mean, for you personally, given that your first major work in gaming was around that sort of 25-year mark, What sort of changes have you experienced or that you think are prevalent in composing music for games now compared to your time at Rare?
Well, you got more memory. I think that's the biggest thing. You got more space. You can use proper quality, you know, proper full quality, well, not quite full quality, but CD soundtracks. You can produce, that's what you do. You know, you produce 44.1 kilohertz. Well, in fact, 48 kilohertz, 24-bit WAVs, we kind of do these days. You know, so I mean, and you can get it in the game because it's got plenty of space. Like, you think back in Banjo-Kazooie, it was like 1 megabit for all the music and all the sound effects.
Oh,
like,
my God.
You know, that, even that was, you know, I think it was a 4 megabit cartridge. Was it 8 megabit? Might have been 8 megabit. You know, GoldenEye was definitely 1 megabit cartridge. 8 megabit cartridge. You know, was it? Oh, I'm getting confused. It was something like that. It was tiny. Anyway,
tiny. But,
you know,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know. So I mean, I think that's the thing. You know, it's, you couldn't get anywhere near the quality we got these days. Like now, that isn't a concern for me anymore. I don't think about taking up too much space. That doesn't occur to me. I just write music, whatever I want, and use that quality. I mean, you know, I think people don't realize that even to this day in games, music isn't absolute full quality. It's still compressed into maybe to a high quality MP3 or an org or whatever, you know, that's really high quality, but it's still not, you know, you're not getting the 48 kilohertz 24-bit wave. You're not getting that yet. It's still compressed.
Yeah.
You know. But I mean, I can't tell the difference. You know, but there must be a difference, because if you look at an MP3 file, let's say it's 30 meg file, it'll get compressed to 3 or 4 meg, right? So you're losing something. I don't know what it is because I can't hear it, but you're losing something. You know what I mean? So that's the biggest thing, I think. But also, MIDI is more manipulatable. So all that kind of channel fading stuff that I used to do in Banjo-Kazooie, well, you know, you had different levels in it with different areas in the level, it would fade to different versions of the tune. That was really easy back in the MIDI file days. Really simple. Like doing it now, it's like you got to crossfade wave files. You know, you got a wave file going along this area, you go to the next area, you got to fade up the second wave file, you got to crossfade the two waves. And then, you know, to start the next tune. And I mean, you know, when you crossfade the two waves, that instantly doubles the memory, right? You've got double memory space you need to take up to do that. You know, and you've got, like, on the ukulele first level, I think there's like 5 different variations of that tune. So you've got 5 waves, you've got a track virtually. So when you do want to crossfade, you're in the right place on the next wave you're going to. You know, so it's way more complicated.
For sure.
And memory takes memory up, you know. So, but, you know, like, and I'm using, you know, high quality sample libraries like the big Spitfire Orchestra libraries. I use those right now. You know, they're fantastic. You know, you can take time over it, you can make it sound like a live orchestra. Some people would never know, you know, that it's not a live orchestra. So I feel like there's all that at your fingertips now. You couldn't do that before, no way. You won't have the space for it. But like, I write music the same way I've always done. I just mess around with something on the keyboard till I like it. It's not like I've got some kind of amazing different process. It's just the same bare bones process that it was back then. You load up a sample, whatever it is, French horn, clarinet, or some kind of synth, and mess around with it to hear some chords that you like or a tune that you like, and then just go from there. You know, it's just, that's how I do it.
Yeah, excellent. And I mean, let's say on average for any Grant Kirkhope composed song, what would the timeline look like from conceptualization to completion? How long would it normally take? And have there perhaps been instances where it's come together super quick or has taken quite a while to put together?
Well, I speak faster. I do everything faster. It's just the way I'm wired. So, you know, unfortunately. So, like, people can't tell what I'm saying half the time over here. I do work really quickly. So, I could, you know, a couple of days, I could get something done probably easy, I would think. You know, a big boss piece might take a bit longer, maybe 3 days, 3-4 days, but it doesn't take me very long to get it done. I've always worked fast like that. It's just who I am. It's not because I'm trying to be fast. I just work fast. It's just my natural way. That's just the way it is. I just work quickly. So I feel like when I did the big boss battles in Kingdoms of Amalur at the time, they maybe took like 5 days because I felt like they were really gigantic, but the big boss battles of Mario, they were pretty big and they didn't take me that long. I kind of feel like I've got better at it probably over the years, hopefully. I'm pretty quick really.
Okay. And I mean, one of the things that I look through, or that I love when I look through your body of work, is apart from a couple of roles like Mumbo Jumbo and a couple of others in the Banjo series, is a lot of your voice acting work is for Donkey Kong in a large number of games, which surprised me personally, having played pretty much all of those games. How did that come about? How did someone at Nintendo go, okay, Grant Kirkhope is the man for the job?
So when we did Donkey Kong 64, We didn't have enough to do the voice. And I just thought I'll do it just to be quick. You know, don't think of, you know, I mean, like, all the voice acting that I've done at Rare, especially, was just like, just because no one else wanted to do it. And I just do it to be fast. Like, a lot of the baddies in Viva Pinata, like the animals and me, just because I could sit in my office, do it quickly, get it in the game, get on with it, you know. So DK was like that. And not for a minute did I think it would go any further than that. But then after the game was done, Nintendo actually asked for the voice samples from DK64, so I sent them across. Not really know what they're going to do with them, really. I mean, they lasted quite a long time. I think I was DK for a number of years, unbeknown to me. I didn't realise I was, but I think I actually was. So quite funny, really, because I kind of thought it was just me messing around. I just did my own voice and just pitched it down. You know, that's how it wasn't like I was in any kind of amazing acting. I wouldn't call it acting. It was just me going, okay, or banana, and just pitch it down like that and stick it in the game, right? But as I say, they asked for the sample, so they used them quite a bit, apparently. So, yes, I was DK. Unwittingly.
It seems like a common thing that happened at Rare, just getting people involved with the game, just into the sound studio and just pitching it down or up. Like, clearly you you had a very maverick attitude to voice acting at that company.
Yeah, also, I think Rare was a very, very secretive place, right? It was known for that. We didn't have any outside contact with the outside world at all. Didn't do any interviews. It was like totally sort of clandestine. So the Stamper Brothers didn't like any outside people coming in to do anything. So you had to do it yourself because it wouldn't let anybody come in to do it. So it came to Viva Pinata and there was like 65 animals. It was like, well, who's going to voice these, you know, kind of thing. So I started off doing quite a lot of them. And then I think as time went on, the team got quite into it and said, look, we'd all like to have a go, really. So I sent an email out saying, I've got an animal up for grabs. Who wants it? And the first person back with the email got to do it, right? So it got quite popular by the time, you know, as time went on. Chris Sutherland, who did a lot of the voices. He did Banjo and Kazooie. He's done tons of other voices. Like, you know, he's done lots of voices at Ray. He did a lot of the voice acting in Perfect Dark. Kind of thing. So, you know, he's very well known for doing the voices and he liked doing it, but there wasn't many other guys that liked to do it. So I just did it myself to be quick. So I did the dog and I can't remember, I did tons of ones in Viva Pinata. Because I just sit there in the office and do it quick, right? It'd be easy to get it in the game. But as I say, it got more popular. So by the time it got to Viva Pinata, people were really, really keen to do it. So they could say, that's me and making that noise when they play it to the kids or whatever, you know, like, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah. So, yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, team building exercise. I love it. Yes. Of course, you've also done compositions for films, both short and feature length. Obviously, The King's Daughter being the major one, and knock on wood, hopefully that does end up seeing the light of day sometime soon. Mm. Is film something that you'd like to explore more as time goes on?
Definitely. I want to do everything. I want to do from mobile film to movies. I want to do the whole lot. Because it's interesting, right? You get to do different things, you know. So it's fun. Like, you just, you know, it's not like I don't want to do games. I love doing games. It's fantastic. You know, and I just feel like as a composer these days, we all like to call ourselves media composers, which kind of encompasses everything. And I think I just like to do it all. Like, anybody, why not? You know, if you can do it, why not do it? So, yeah, I've done a few shorts. I've just done these two feature films for Michael Matteo Rossi, who's like a director over here. One's called Shadows, one's called The Handler, which will be out this year, I think, both together. I've done that, bringing back GoldenEye for my friends in Yorkshire in England, that comedy, which is pretty funny. And The King's Daughter, that's that one with Pierce Brosnan and William Hurt and all that nonsense in it. Just hasn't come out yet. God knows what's going on with it. It's been years. But it's done, it's finished, it's finished ages ago. I don't quite know what the problem is. I think they're fighting over distribution, I think. But I really honestly don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, and I mean, on the other side of the spectrum, I did look through some of your work and found that you did a game called Fart Cat.
All right,
quite a number of years ago. It seems like the only one of the titles that doesn't really get talked about. What was the deal with that? How does someone like Grant Kirkhope end up on a game called Fart Cat?
So when I worked for the Kingdom of Amalur studio, Big Huge Games, who were owned by Kurt Schilling's 38 Studios, and that all went bust and the whole thing with Kurt Schilling, you know. But one of the guys who worked at 38 Studios said, I've got this stupid little game called Fart Cat. Do you want to write a tune for it? I said, yeah, why not? And that was it. So I just did it for a joke. I did it. I mean, I can't remember how it goes. But I did that tune for him.
Nice. Very, very good. Where to next for you then? What's next for Grant Kirkhope? Is there a dream project you'd like to put your name to forward that you want to project out into the world?
I don't know about that. I mean, I guess I can only really talk about Sparks, I hope, because I'm working on other stuff that I can't talk about yet. You know, movie-wise, nothing in the pipeline movie-wise at the moment. I think something might pop up very shortly, but nothing else. Trouble with games composers, you can't really mention what you're working on. So when it's movies, they announce everything in advance and everyone knows about it, but games, they can't do it because no one knows what the game is, right? So you just can't talk about games. So Sony Sparks, I hope, like I mentioned right now.
Keeping tight-lipped, I love it.
Yeah.
And I guess just to wrap up, you've obviously been in this field for quite some time now, and I'm sure you've seen a number of composers come and go. What sort of advice would you give to people who are thinking about composing for games? What's the lasting piece of information that you would give them?
I've got a few things I would say about this. And I feel like, you know, number one, it's not easy. And don't think it is, because it isn't. You really have to dedicate your entire existence to it. Like, it's hard. You know, I'd say as a young composer, you know, don't fight with the creative director, whatever it is. If he says, a lot of times composers think they know best, right? And it's like, well, what's the game designer know? He hasn't got a clue what he's talking about. Like, that doesn't matter what you think. It only matters what they think. Like, you know, if they don't like the piece of music you've written, there's no amount of you telling them how great the chord sequence is or the harmonic elaboration or, you know, or how great the tune is. It's going to change their mind. They just don't like it, right? They probably can't articulate why. They say, I don't like it. You do it again. And the more you argue, you're just going to get fired. You know, because there's 8 million people stood behind you who want that job, right? So they're just going to get somebody else to do it. Like, don't do that. It's a stupid idea. And also I think people think they can write great music and just put it on YouTube somewhere or a website and then someone's going to find it and employ you. That's just probably going to be really unlikely because everyone does that. You could write the best music in the world, but no one's probably going to hear it because on a website somewhere, who's going to find it? You know, you have to get out there and meet people. I think us composers normally don't like doing that. We're kind of introverts. We don't like to go out and talk to anybody if we can help it. You know, but you have to do that. Go to your conventions, your game jams, whatever it is. You need to get yourself into that space where people are doing the thing that you want to do. So you're all like-minded together. You know, I feel like people don't understand that networking part is equally as important as the talent part. And I think it's 50% ability, 50% who you know. I really think it's that big. So, you know, I got offered work because I've been around a long time and people can remember stuff I did in the past and can say, oh, well, let's find that bloke, where is he? And they can kind of track me down, right, to do stuff. If you're an unknown person, they're never going to track you down because they don't know who you are, no matter how good you are. It's not easy. I find it difficult, you know. I think that people don't really understand that part of it. The networking thing is massively... I give the example of, like, Danny Baranowski, who... We're great friends. Who did Super Meat Boy and Binding of Isaac and Cannibalt and Necrodancer, you know, the thing, and the Zelda one too. Like, Danny was that guy who worked in Lowe's and Home Depot over here, just, you know, in a store working, dreaming of being a video game composer. And he actually got one of his tracks, actually one of my Perfect Dark tracks, he remixed it and got it onto the thing over here called OC Remix, which is like a website for people to remix, you know, game stuff. And the guy that did Cannibalt heard it. Content said, I love that thing you did. Do you want to work on my game? And it was just just his little game. But that got Danny known then, and this Meat Boy guy saw that, and he got Meat Boy and all the rest of it, and off he goes, you know. Our Daniel Rosenfeld, who's like C418, he did all the Minecraft stuff. Like, he was just in a chat room when Notch was looking for a composer. You know, they were just in the game's infancy. He said, I can write music, and he got the gig. And then, you know, he's probably the most followed composer on Twitter, you know, kind of thing. You know, he's probably way above anybody else. You know, he did all the early Minecraft stuff that everybody knows and loves. You know, I think that everyone's got their own little story, you know, but just sitting in your bedroom writing great tunes, putting them on a website somewhere is probably not going to get you anywhere. So get out there, meet people. I know it's hard, but get out there and do it.
Excellent stuff. Well, Grant, this has been eye-opening, to say the least, and I must thank you hugely for coming down to sit and have a chat. Is there anywhere that people can follow your work, or any social handles that people can follow you on?
Well, I've got my website, grantkirkhope.com. There's bits and pieces on there. I'm on Twitter's my main thing, I guess, really, at Grant Kirkhope. I'm on TikTok and the rest, but I think Instagram and all that, the rest of it, you know, but I guess I don't really use it, but I'm on there. I occasionally look at it. But Twitter's my main thing, really, I guess that's for my age group, I suppose.
Yeah.
I feel like Facebook's the oldies, Twitter's the halfways, and then you're getting younger as you go to Instagram and the rest of it, you know what I mean? Because my daughter's 15, she's more of an Instagrammer. You know, she thinks Twitter's for the oldies. So there you go. Yes, I'm on there. You can catch me on there. I can't think where else am I? I think that's good enough. I've got a YouTube page, but I never use it. very rarely. So.
Yes, and of course, ladies and gentlemen, if you do want to follow anything that we have been doing, you can always follow the show at OPG Pod, and you can follow me on Twitter at It's Tilby. But from me, Matt Tilby, and my very special guest, Grant Kirkhope, it is goodbye for now. Take care.